Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with... You were expecting Tom McDonald. Ha! Wrong. Today, it's Steve Gardonis. Steve is, Tom's a little bit under the weather, and Steve needed a whole hour, an entire hour, to talk about... Superheroes.
Yes,
because we're coming up with I think my things are about the Civil War film coming out. Of course, whenever I mention the Civil War film, like, my wife looks at me and goes, there's a movie about Abraham Lincoln coming out. It was Captain America saying, "We believe in the Holy Spirit who proceeds, Father." and then the Jungle Book last night.
Did you?
Yes. Well, and the great thing about going to see the Jungle Book this far after
I just want to say we're on this subject on my sufferance because the Jungle Book is not about superheroes.
That's true.
This is a little.
I appreciate you letting me divert my show to something that I wanted to talk about for a minute. That's generous of you, but so I'm sorry, Mr. Gardonis. I just wanted to talk about something else for just a moment. So we went and saw the Jungle Book last night. Great thing about going to see the Jungle Book at a 9:40 showing on a Monday night, weeks after it's come out, is you have it's your own personal theater. There's no one else there. I really enjoyed it. It was lots of fun. What's that?
You see it in 3D.
I did not, sadly. Okay. But you know, I liked Bill Murray's Baloo the Bear. I thought he was great. It was an amazing tribute to the filmmaker's art and the ability to create a world really out of thin air. I mean, you're aware that, you know, this wasn't really filmed in the jungle, but you forget it.
Yes.
And it was just, it was an amazing piece of creation. So hats off to Jon Favreau, who also is responsible for launching the entire Marvel franchise, practically, by making Iron Man. Although, really, of course, Spider-Man launched the franchise, you know, a decade or so ago.
Well, but let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Because... All right, let's talk. There's so many different ways we could go here. Since you were on the subject of the Jungle Book, I wanted to mention that feat that you were talking about of creating a world that you know isn't real, but that you forget it, is something that Pope Pius XII talks about in his 1955 address on the ideal film. He talks about the film's ability to transport the spectator into an unreal world and the use of the technical skill of nature's colors and the three dimensions of space. And he even alludes to the 3D of the time when he says that the present time is striving with daring ingenuity to place the spectator amidst the scene itself. This is Pope Pius XII's Apostolic Exhortations, 1955, to the Italian film industry on the ideal film. And he talks about the ability of cinema to do. And it was just in its infancy at that time in 1955. And now, when you go to see The Jungle Book, you are seeing the fruition of what the Pope is talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was fun to watch. Given the fact that my wife at a number of points in the movie, you know, practically leapt out of her seat and then grabbed my arm because she was there's a number of moments in the movie where you have a heart attack. A movie I would bring my 6-year-old granddaughter to.
Although I have heard from parents of 6-year-olds who loved it.
Really? Okay. So, yes, well,
I would not recommend it across the board to 6-year-olds. You have to know your kid.
Yeah.
I would say 9 and up, you're probably okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. So well done to the makers of The Jungle Book. I thought it was great. And plus saw trailers for one movie after another that I thought, I think I'll probably go see that too. So I'm tingling with anticipation. Although no trailer for the Civil War. I was... So there we go. But I hear that's going to be out this week, Steve. Would you like to talk about that?
Oh, boy, would I?
Okay.
So let me give you some perspective.
Okay.
I grew up, the speech that you get from your parents about how they walked uphill in the snow both ways to school every day, 10 miles and so forth. I grew up in an era where Stan Lee was promising us comic book fans that Daredevil was going to be a movie and Captain America was going to be a movie and Spider-Man was going to be a movie. And I believed him. And this was in the late 1970s and early 1980s when I was a comic book reader. And all of those promises just fell through totally, and my dreams were crushed. I always wanted to go to the movies and see my heroes on the screen. We got the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, and then eventually we got the Tim Burton Batman movies, which I was not very happy about, and so on and so forth. And at some point, around the time that I got married, I think, so in the early 1980s, my wife Suzanne and I, we were watching an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Uh-huh. And I looked at Captain Picard and something clicked in my head. And I'm sure I was not the first person to have this thought, but I thought, oh my goodness, Patrick Stewart, he would be a professor, a perfect Professor X. And then as soon as I thought that, I laughed and I said, of course, they're never going to make an X-Men movie. And if they did, they would never cast Patrick Stewart.
Okay.
Imagine my delight in 2000, the year that I first created decentfilms.com. The very year X-Men, Bryan Singer's film, came along and really inaugurated in a very significant way the era of the modern era of comic book movies in which we live. Mm-hmm. X-Men was an important and an interesting film in many ways. From a formal perspective, X-Men did three things that were interesting and different. Where earlier superhero movies had treated superpowers and the comic book milieu in a very fast and loose way. You know, when you watch Tim Burton's Batman movies, Gotham City is clearly a stylized Art Deco kind of a set. It's not meant to be a real city that anybody actually lives in. It's not meant to persuade you. It's meant to be arty.
Right.
And
Everything that Tim Burton does is that way. I mean,
right.
It's
a very stylized presentation of reality. And the Christopher Reeve movies, as classic as they are, and as much as I love them, they're always pulling new superpowers out of, let's say, Superman's belly button. He's amnesia kisses and the ability to fly around the world backwards and turn time backwards. And he rips the S off of his chest and it becomes a big net and disappearing and appearing and levitating finger beams and all of this stuff.
Levitating finger beams are really painful to watch. You know, I was, because I was the guy that grew up on the DC comics. And it's like, uh-huh, he can't do that. Right. That is not possible for him to do that.
Well, you just have to accept that it's an alternate interpretation of Superman in some fairy tale universe.
No, that's not possible.
Well, what X-Men did was it gave us a recognizably real world in which you don't just have one marquee hero with his superpowers and it's all about that one person. And it created a world in which superpowers are rare, but they're a regular phenomenon. People have them. Some people, rare people, mutants. And some of them are good guys and some of them are bad guys and some of them are just regular people who are just trying to go through life. And the rest of the world does not just sit by and accept that this is the way things are. You know, there's discussion and debate and mutual suspicion and distrust between mutants and non-mutants. And there's a whole sociological phenomenon, and it's provocative and it's thoughtful. And Bryan Singer picking up on themes in the original comic books, he created something that was really special, and he opened the door to exploring whole worlds, comic book worlds, rather than just, you know, the life of one hero. And that was all very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And we will continue this discussion right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Steve Gradonis, and we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Steve Gradonis, who we're talking about the upcoming, the first big blockbuster of the summer. I think we can call it summer because it's May, and that's good enough for me. So the Captain America versus Iron Man Civil War film coming out, that comes out this Friday. And Steve got a chance to screen it yesterday. So you were talking about you had a brilliant insight, which you managed to talk yourself out of, that Patrick Stewart would be a great Professor X. And then you managed to persuade yourself that that would never happen. It happened.
It did happen. It was amazing. And what I have since come to appreciate about that franchise, as other superhero movies have come and gone, and we had the Spider-Man movies and the very successful Dark Knight trilogy, Christopher Nolan starring Christian Bale as Batman, and then the Marvel universe got kicked off with Iron Man in 2008, directed by Jon Favreau, as you pointed out, and the other superhero movies that have come along. And we'll talk about what is unique and distinctive about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and what it has really contributed to the modern era of superhero movies that we live in, and how it's really redefined it again after X-Men. But before
just one thing that I want to discuss briefly, just because it's bugged me for years, if you'll pardon the pun, but for some reason, they kept doing they would tell the same origin story. Here's Spider-Man. Right. And here's Spider-Man again.
Right.
And here's the Hulk. And here's the Hulk again. Right. And I wish they would just stop doing that.
My friend Peter Chataway points to Marvel's The Incredible Hulk as the turning point here, where a character was rebooted less than, I think it was less than 5 years after he'd been introduced in the first place.
Right.
And this was really the beginning of the era of rapid fire reboots. And again, in just that way, Spider-Man was rebooted again, and other characters have been rebooted. And I can understand. And first of all, we've seen other characters be recast in loose continuities, James Bond and so forth. But with James Bond, you know, his origin story was never that important until Casino Royale came out in 2006, I think. That was such a brilliant film. But we really are crazy to retell the origins of these stories. And you'll appreciate the fact that Civil War introduces the Marvel Cinematic Universe incarnation of Spider-Man without telling his origin.
Well, good.
So, yeah.
Because we all know it.
We all know it. We've seen it twice.
We've met him three different times, you know.
So I'm not against retelling the origins, but I think it's interesting to see a new version of the character in which they don't bother to do that.
Yeah.
But seeing the vast proliferation of characters in the Marvel universe has made me appreciate something about the X-Men series. And it really started with Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man. And I think that Jon Favreau, who is very talented at putting together a great cast and picking the right actors, picking Robert Downey Jr. really launched the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He was going out on a limb for Downey Jr. at that point in his career. He was not as hot then as he is now. And Downey Jr. gave a fantastic performance, really created a very memorable character. And I have to give credit to Gwyneth Paltrow as Pepper Potts. I think that she is the franchise's secret weapon, and she has not always gotten the recognition that is her due. I think that she and Tony in the first movie particularly, they have a great kind of screwball comedy banter, and she is, in my opinion, the best comic book love interest in any superhero movie of all time.
Yeah.
But what they did with Robert Downey Jr. was they really established the pattern, which has been perpetuated to almost all of the Marvel heroes, and certainly most of the big ones, which is the theme that these heroes are as in need of as much redemption themselves as the world that they inhabit is in need of saving.
Mm-hmm.
So they may be men of iron, but they have feet of clay. Mm-hmm. And that's as true of Chris Pratt's that's as true of Chris Pratt's Star-Lord, mm-hmm. as it is of Tony Stark and Chris Hemsworth's Thor. The list goes on. All of these heroes, they start out in need of comeuppance. Mm-hmm. And they have some kind of redemptive arc, but really the most persuasive redemptive arc was the very first one. You watch Iron Man. Iron Man is a redemption story.
Right.
It's the story of a selfish, venal person who is very satisfied with his own answers about his own life, but who gets a hard dose of reality. He comes into personal contact with the consequences of his reckless actions and the actions of other people on his behalf. The principal way that his company makes money, he really takes it in the chest on this, and
so to speak,
and he decides that he needs to make sacrifices, and in order to be a more responsible person and to try to take responsibility for his company, for his own legacy, for the legacy of his father, and so on. And when they tried to replicate that pattern to other characters like Thor and Star-Lord, it hasn't been as persuasively done. I think Thor was really the first example of a character who they don't really establish up front just how in need of redemption he is, and then he doesn't really get all that redeemed. He doesn't have that much of a journey, and not that much happens in right. Thor's first movie. And this is a problem from which subsequent movies have also suffered.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that that Iron Man was one of the strongest characters in the franchise, and especially because it was so perfectly cast. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is just one of those guys who's compulsively watchable. He's just, you know, has that charm that you just find attractive, even when he's being a repulsive character. It's you somehow like the guy anyway. And so it'll be interesting to watch this film, because he's going to be taking such a lead. And on the one hand, you know, Captain America's character is such a goody two-shoes that he'll be the good guy, but in a weird way. I think I suspect we'll somehow wind up empathizing with Iron Man in a strange way. Anyway, we'll see. Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away, but I will say I saw the movie with my 18-year-old son, David, and David felt very strongly that Iron Man, Tony Stark, really had the right of the argument and that Captain America was in the wrong pretty much throughout the film.
Okay.
And he argued this view with real insight, and I appreciated his arguments. Mm-hmm. It is Captain America's movie, and clearly the movie wants you to empathize with him, and we see some of the negative consequences of the road that Tony Stark goes down. Mm-hmm. But the tension between these two characters is really a continuation of what we saw in the Avengers, which is the first time all these characters got together. And what's interesting about the Avengers is that it continues Tony's moral arc, his redemptive arc, by pitting Tony's milieu, which is really a kind of baby boomer, me generation perspective, with the perspective that Steve Rogers, Captain America, ostensibly represents, which is that of the greatest generation, the generation of self-sacrifice, the generation that survived the Depression and beat the Nazis. Their conflict really revolves around the idea of selflessness and sacrifice.
Right.
When Captain America says to Iron Man, you know, take away the suit and what are you? And Iron Man's response is millionaire or billionaire, playboy, genius, philanthropist.
Right.
Steve comes right back at him with, I've known guys who had none of that and were worth 10 times what you are. It's like, you know, you're not the kind of guy who's going to lie down on a wire in order to let his buddy crawl over him to freedom. And Steve and Iron Man's response is, I think I just cut the wire. And Steve says, you've always got an easy answer, you know, but life doesn't always offer us easy answers. Sometimes it is necessary to make that sacrifice. And what we see in the film is that Steve's goading gets under Tony's skin. And when it comes down to it, there is the possibility that a real sacrifice is going to have to be made in order to save New York from something really, really bad. And Iron Man is able to make that heroic sacrifice because he's been goaded into it by Steve Rogers. And that's an interesting dynamic. I didn't pick up on that the first time I watched the film, but on subsequent viewings, and someone was helpful to me in helping me realize that that's really what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah. And that really is a, you know, I remember hearing Michael Medved one time making the argument that, you know, the message of, for example, a film like Casablanca. Oh, well, and now we're up against a break, but we'll put a pin in Casablanca and return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gardanis talking about the new Marvel film, Civil War. And we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steven Gradonis. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4BREAD-4, 1-573-4BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number, or you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. I was going to say, before the break, we were talking about two fundamental messages that often get broadcast in films. Michael Medved pointed this out, that the message of films of, for example, The Greatest Generation tend to be do your duty messages. So, you know, the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. If this plane leaves and you're not on it, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life, says Rick to Elsa at the end of Casablanca. And so she does her duty, even though she loves him. She does her duty and goes off to support the anti-war effort. And the other great message, and it's become a much more popular message, especially with baby boomers, a generation I regret that I belong to, or Generation Narcissus, as I prefer to call it. And that message, which sometimes, sure, is something that needs to be heard, but a lot of times it's not something that needs to be heard. That message is follow your heart. The epitome, I think, of probably the worst places where we see that are in films like, for example, Eat, Pray, Love.
Mm-hmm. Where, or the Bridges, you know, of Madison County.
Right, where, you know, someone just decides, well, I don't feel affirmed in my okayness. I'm not being fulfilled in my life. So I'm just going to ditch my family and go off on a spiritual quest where I learn that I'm the most awesome center of the universe that there is. And I eat things that I like to eat too. And then I fall in love with somebody who affirms me in my okayness, you know, until the next time I get bored with my life, I guess. Yes, like I say, there can be real moments where follow your heart is the right thing to do because you're following what God has spoken to your conscience. So it's important, for example, for Francis of Assisi to, at that, you know, that crucial juncture in his life, Francis really does have to follow his heart. And he, you know, when his father's demanding, you know, that he, you know, he get his dough back, and he says, well, here, and he takes off all of his clothes and hands them, you know, says, I'm following God from now on. That can be a real genuine choice of conscience, and something that's done in obedience to God. But in our culture, almost always these days, what follow your heart means, it just means follow your appetites. You know, do whatever you feel like, regardless of the consequences to the innocent people whose lives you harm and destroy. And that is a real contrast. And I think that there is certainly, you know, for somebody like Tony Stark, who's on a redemption journey, it's nonetheless a temptation that he can face.
Yes.
Now, there's also you know, there are temptations that do your duty can face as well. I dare say that many of the Pharisees who hated Jesus were people who saw themselves as grasping the nettle and doing their duty, you know, despite, you know, everything in them to the contrary that said, don't do this evil thing. You know, one of the things that I noticed several years ago is that when people are deliberately choosing to commit mortal sin, they virtually always describe what they're doing in using the language of courage. It's a weird phenomenon, but you really see it, that when people are doing something that is really despicably evil and they know it, they talk about themselves as they're incredibly brave. I'm willing to sacrifice my very soul for this great noble cause. And so there is a temptation that can go with doing your duty. You can sometimes tell yourself you're doing your duty when what you're really doing is choosing grave evil and preferring to think of yourself as courageous for doing it. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. I've been talking too much.
Well, the point that you were just making about the temptation of doing your duty is something that Captain America Civil War explores in its own pop culture way, in the struggle between Iron Man's conscience and Steve Rogers' conscience. And it really is a battle of consciences between these two men. And this is potentially, and I'm not going to say that this is one of the most interesting examples of it, but I think that it really is the highest form of drama. Not good versus evil, not man versus nature, or even man versus himself, but one good versus another good. Mm-hmm. When you have two characters who are opposed, who are both trying to follow their conscience, and who both have a case, who both believe in something and are both willing to sacrifice for the good that they believe in. And it's not one person believes in a good cause and one person believes in a bad cause, but where mm-hmm. you can have sympathy with both sides. I think that that is potentially the highest form of drama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I don't say that Captain America Civil War is the highest example of it, because it certainly isn't.
Right.
But what you have is a conflict between Iron Man's troubled conscience when he confronts the fact that the Avengers, in being answerable to no one and going around the world and trying to save lives and really saving lives, but also doing a great deal of destruction and being involved in a great many deaths in the process. How do you think the people of the world feel about that? You know, that they're accountable to no one, and they're just out there, and they're going into other countries, crossing over borders and whatnot. The United Nations comes to the Avengers and says, we need to, you know, there needs to be oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony, in his troubled conscience, says, yes, I agree. There needs to be oversight. I'm on board. Mm-hmm. Sign me up. But Steve Rogers feels that if he sees something bad happening, he's not going to wait for someone to sign off on it before he intervenes, and he's willing to go rogue in order to fight for that principle. And then, of course, you have the whole conflict between the two men in terms of their personalities that comes into play. Tony's very complicated feelings about his father, who, of course, was someone that Steve Rogers knew from having been alive back during World War II. And so what you have is an interesting pop culture conflict that goes so far beyond the incredibly shallow, ridiculous, contrived contrast or conflict between Batman and Superman in Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. You can't help watching this movie and seeing it as a rebuke to that other film on every level.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that I said about Batman versus Superman is that when Batman and Superman fight for the first time, then they really go at it in Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. It's at the end of Batman's career, and he has a long and complicated history with Superman. And so there's all kinds of history and subtext and personal agendas and issues that comes into play when these two titans go at it. You know, in Batman versus Superman, Zack Snyder was just so eager to get to the bloodletting that he gave these characters no time to get to know each other, to begin to get on each other's nerves a little bit, to recognize each other's strengths and weaknesses, and to give their conflict emotional heft. Then he just manipulates them into fighting each other at the whim of a bad guy when it doesn't make sense for the plot and it doesn't make sense for the characters, but they're going through the mechanics because the plot requires it. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that what happens in Civil War is any kind of profound statement, but it works on a purely pop culture level in terms of the characters and in terms of the themes in a way that Batman versus Superman is just a big hot mess. So there you have it.
Well, which is why I didn't go and see it. Anything that Zack Snyder's name is associated with, I just figure, why spend that $10? But that's one of the things that the Greeks were very fond of was exactly this. I mean, their drama at its best. It wasn't so much about good versus evil as it was about competing goods. You've got people who feel a duty, something that was taken very seriously, an ancestral duty to, bury your dead. Oh, and we're up against the break again, but we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Steve Gardonis, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. Moving on from the Civil War, which I'm looking forward to seeing. It's tough, you know, when you see these movies a week ahead of everybody else, and you know everything about them, but you can't say too much because you have to keep all the plot twists a secret and everything.
To me, it's a thrill to talk and write about a movie in a way that is meaningful but doesn't give away key plot points. I love to do that. So I'm going to be sitting down tonight and writing my review, and I'm looking forward to it. To wrap up what we were talking about, I want to say I thoroughly enjoyed Civil War. It is Marvel movie making at just about its peak efficiency. Super fun, ridiculously entertaining. The less you think about the plot, the happier you will be. Just groove on the action scenes and the characters and the themes and forget about the plot. But I also want to say how great it was to see a third incarnation of my all-time favorite superhero, not my personal hero from all the characters on the cinematic screen, but my all-time favorite, the Amazing Spider-Man, because of course I was Peter Parker when I was in high school. And so I love Spider-Man. Yes. Well, they have a great new take on him. This is he's played by a 19-year-old British actor who does a credible Queen's accent in the film, and he really comes across as a geeky high schooler. And we only get a glimpse of the costume that he's been swinging around New York in, but it really looks like a costume that he might have come up with. And there's an alternate explanation for his super cool, super slick Spider-Man suit that he wears in this movie, which I just love, and which actually has some connection to the comic books. So that's all okay. Interesting. All right. Great character, lots of fun, really enjoyed it. But I'm looking forward to X-Men Apocalypse later in the month of May, because more than this film, it is directed by Bryan Singer, who has done the best X-Men movies so far. First two, X-Men X2, and then X-Men Days of Future Past. And the X-Men movies have explored the moral themes that we were talking about at the top of the hour of prejudice and fear and tolerance and suspicion and even duty and sacrifice in ways that are more interesting to me than anything that any of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies have done.
Okay.
And I want to say, when I look at the modern comic book movie landscape and I see all of the semi-redeemed frat boys of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's really what they are. You know, other than Captain America, where are the heroes? Who are the I see characters who do heroic things, but where are the characters who are truly selfless and heroic and have an inspiring vision, somebody that you would want to admire and emulate, somebody that you would like to try to look at and to live up to? And I don't see that character in the Marvel Cinematic. Again, Captain America aside, but Captain America isn't really developed as much as a character in a way to really fill that role. And part of the reason is because they wanted him to be universal in his appeal. And so they kind of stripped him of some of his American identity. He doesn't talk about democracy and freedom and the Constitution. He's basically a global humanist because they want to be able to sell him, you know, in China. So, so he can't be all that American.
Right.
But so, and I look at, Christian Bale's Batman and the Spider-Man of any of the incarnations of Spider-Man so far, and I don't really see a character who inspires me, except one. There is one. And he's a character in the X-Men movies. And he's the character that we started at the hour talking about. Patrick Stewart's Professor Charles Xavier. Here is a character who has an inspiring vision for a better world that he has given his life to achieving, to bettering other people, helping them to not just to master their skills, but to conquer their fears. A friend of mine said on my Facebook page that he is a character who fights for a more compassionate world in an age of fear. And this is really the hero for our times. And I thought, wow, how true that is. You know, in the Civil War schema, not civil, in the civil rights schema of the X-Men mythology, Professor X is the Martin Luther King character. He's the character who tries to bridge the gaps between one population and another. And Magneto, of course, is the Malcolm X character, the one who wants what's right for his own side by any means necessary, including radical violence.
Yeah.
But that Martin Luther King-esque message, that message of reaching out across divisions and trying to help people overcome fear and preferring nonviolence to violence, that continues to resonate as a very vital message in our time. Yeah. And even Patrick Stewart is not, I think, going to be in this next movie. We're going to see the younger version of the character played by James McAvoy. But I'm hoping that as time goes by, we will see McAvoy, who also starts out as a kind of a, well, he's got a little bit of a frat boy in him in X-Men First Class. I'm hoping that he will begin to acquire that nobility and that seasoned wisdom that Patrick Stewart's character has that I find so inspiring.
Well, and one of the things that, that Patrick Stewart's character, well, will ultimately do, of course, is he's a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the role that he fills. And so peacemaking is one of the things upon which Jesus confers a blessing in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they should be called the children of God. And one of the things that's noticeable about the Beatitudes is that the Beatitudes consistently confer, the blessings of the Beatitudes are all blessings on Lenten things. They're all things that we don't want to do. You know, who wants to be poor? Who wants to hunger and thirst? Who wants to mourn? Who wants to be persecuted? And peacemaking is among those Lenten things. Peacemaking sounds really nice till you have to do it, and then it sucks. Peacemaking is just, it's miserable work from a worldly perspective because everybody hates you. You're a fifth columnist to your enemies, and you're a traitor to your friends. And And so one of the things that St. Paul points out in Ephesians is that Jesus made peace, he says, through his blood. That's how peace is made in the Christian tradition, and that's how peace is made in the real world. Peacemaking requires the willingness to offer your own blood, the willingness to die, which is exactly, of course, what Martin Luther King will prove with his life, and as will Professor X in the X-Men universe. And that, you know, willingness to recognize that real peacemaking is costly, that there is a blessing on it. There really is a blessing on it. That's why Jesus includes it in the Beatitudes, as there is a blessing on all the other things, the hard things that Jesus commends in the Beatitudes. But it first involves the recognition that it's a hard thing, that this is not something where you have a problem and you solve it in a half an hour with a couple of wise words, and everybody kind of looks introspective for a minute, and then it's all better. And I appreciated that about Professor X's character, that he's a character who recognizes the costliness of peacemaking.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Catholic, very Catholic insight, I thought. So.
Yeah.
And which, by the way, is something else that's, I think, worth mentioning, is that the Marvel Universe has never shied away from the religious commitments of his characters. You have superheroes who are, you know, practicing Jews. You have superheroes who are serious Catholics. I mean,
Daredevil. In the comics.
In the comics. Who would Daredevil be if he wasn't a Catholic going to confession on a regular basis? You know, and the Nightcrawler another Catholic character. And I like that all that comes into their world, that this is not a sort of a Star Trek universe in which religion has been sanitized from the scene.
There was an interesting run on the Amazing Spider-Man comic book written by J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5 fame, in which he developed, and Straczynski is not a believer, but he's always been friendly to faith in his fiction, and he really developed Spider-Man's prayer life. Spider-Man has a really kind of a Job-like arguing prayer life, talking to God, and it's
fascinating.
Really appreciated that.
Well, listen, Steve, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. Our producer was Ethan Boland. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots here on BreadBox Media. I'll be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. Till then, see you later.